The political climate of late here in the U.S. has certainly proved itself to be something we should all be ashamed of. The skies are dark and threatening, and the temperature amongst us has risen considerably. Civil and moral inhibitions are quickly melting. The winds are driving us all to the political extremes rather than to the more sensible middle. I know that many people out there struggle to see the relevancy of the Bible in modern times. Most of all have a distaste for the mixture of politics and religion. I would like today to spend a short time, however, considering the relevance of at least the proverbial wisdom of King Solomon. And there may not be a more observable segment of modern life to prove its relevancy than in this current political climate. So today's text is Proverbs chapter 6, verses 16 through 19. I'll trust that you'll, you know, get your Bible out, you'll read it, look it up on your phone, whatever. We'll examine this a bit. But what is listing here are seven things that the Lord hates. How do these seven things apply to the political climate as it already stands? And how do these seven things apply to the possible changes that we could make in our political climate to bring it back down to something less hostile, less dangerous? Let's take a short time to consider them then. 6:16 begins, "These six things doth the Lord hate, yea, seven are an abomination to him." You may not believe in a God or a Lord as much as I do. That may not fully be necessary to today's conversation because these are seven things that every one of us should hate about our political environment currently as well. And I ask you not only to consider these items as what other people are doing to you in this current environment, but also what you and I are doing towards others. What we ourselves are partially or fully guilty of. The first one is a proud look. Think of that as the exalted eye. This is the "my view is better than yours" attitude. Be it left or right or moderate, we are all guilty of this. And I'll speak to this first from my own conservative background. Being a white, middle-class, middle-aged conservative male, I am seen by others as racist, as chauvinist, as bigoted, as homophobic, as Neanderthal, as somehow privileged. Oh, if people only knew. In the modern climate, I'm being told that I was born that way. And that there is nothing that I can do about it. Nothing that I can say or support or vote for is valid. Nor is it anything that I can do is humane or socially acceptable. I don't know how anyone expects to win my vote when they look down upon me with such a disgust as they do. You might say the very same thing about some of my viewpoints as well. Granted. My conservative views are seen as wanting to starve hungry children, strip women of their health care choices and their rights, keep young adults from attending college, kill off people with pre-existing medical conditions, poison our air and poison our water and poison our young children's minds. If that's your view of me, then you, sir, are the one with the proud, proud, self-exalted eye. There is absolutely no valid reason for you believing that about me other than that you are using that notion to grab for yourself power. When it comes right down to it, every one of us likely sees things close to the same ground level. There is very little possible justification for any of us to believe that through all this murky muck, somehow we or our party see anything any clearer than anyone else. And so how can we change this? More and more, now knowing this abhorrence of the Lord to this behavior, when I watch the political debates on TV, I'm going to be watching that for which candidate uses this proud eye approach or tactic the most to sell their agenda. The most, I say, because they all use this approach nowadays. When I hear friends and family employ this, I confront them then and there. What makes you think that I would vote to starve children? Do you really see me as such an ogre? What about this program or this policy starves hungry children? You see, most often, we both see the same problem needing to be addressed. That's not where our difference is. What we differ on is how best to address that problem. That difference does not make either you or I an ogre. It makes us thoughtful people on an equal level that need to come together and politically work something out. Second item here is a lying tongue. Think of this as deceiving speech or deceiving communication. And this is the ends justify the means mentality. What is best is that I end up with all the power, or my party ends up with all the power. What does it matter what I say or do or promise, as long as I end up with the power that I want and need? Now, not all of us individually are guilty of that. We can both say with certainty that oftentimes, though, our parties or our politicians have acted as if so indeed. Remember now that deceiving words are not only speaking flat-out falsehoods. Not many of us are actually guilty of that. No, included this in this are all the half or three-quarter truths, the convenient omissions of facts, the misrepresentation of facts as they exist. This includes not only the words we form intended for our own mouths to speak, but also the words heard from other mouths that we simply pass along without correcting or fact-checking. In the age of Facebook and Twitter, lies can be reposted by several unsuspecting accomplices and transmitted across the world in the time it takes a truth seeker to tie his or her shoelace and get after it. Seems today that we so want the narrative to make sense that we are willing to overlook the clearer but deeper or hidden facts. Or the facts that we don't have personal time to dig into. You and I are both guilty of this. You and I should both be wanting to immediately change this. Power and control are never as important as the plain and well-investigated truth. How do we change this in this political climate? More and more now, knowing this abhorrence of the Lord to this deceptive speech behavior, else, if you're not fully on board with that, at least else knowing how much we both mutually hate this, knowing this, I listen a whole lot more intensely to the narrative as it's being presented for the confirmable facts. And the facts I need to look up, I need to look into, right? Not just the inflaming sentiment that's being produced or manufactured by it, but for the confirmable facts. That, along with the observance of this proud look we've already talked about, helps me clue into who might be more likely to be using this against us. Third thing here listed here is hands that shed innocent blood. Think of this as spilling blameless blood or life substance. Now, of course, this particular 2020 political season has brought a whole lot more physical violence, and yes, even bloodshed. And that is not so much what I want to talk about here today, though. Blood is a life substance. You have it and you live. You don't have it, or you lose too much of it and you don't live. Simple as that. Blood can just as well mean livelihood. A person's ability to conduct business, as a result of a person's reputation or a person's ability to reasonably provide others a product or service. When our political climate affects a person's livelihood, it is the same thing as shedding innocent blood. Innocent in the Hebrew here is meaning clear, or clean or blameless or exempt. In politics, there's very few, if any, that are exempt, clean, or blameless. Politics, the psalmists say, is a blood sport. But neither can innocence readily be claimed by the voting public. They are the ones who put these vipers in there. The reason there are not more of this innocent politician is because it is their blood that's typically is being shed, the innocent blood. The reason that there aren't more innocent voters is because we're all hiding behind our politics, slithering our way to what we most greedily want. Our guilt is transferred onto them, the politician, so that we can feel better or more innocent about ourselves. Maybe innocence isn't the word we should be using this far into the current political season. Maybe it's just the long-distant ideal of what innocence should have been before we started all of this. The longing to return to that, if that ever was, you know. What do we do to change this about our political climate? More and more, now knowing this abhorrence of the Lord to this shedding of innocent blood behavior, or else at least knowing how much we both mutually hate this, I guess we have to agree to a mutual truce long enough to take the plank out of our own eyes in order to be able to help with the speck in each other's eye. Fourth thing is a heart that deviseth wicked imaginations. Think of this as plowing, like a farmer would, plowing the furrows out in the field, planting in vain contrivances, plural. It was imaginations, plural. The wickedness in this phrase might be best described as vanity. Sometimes it means, you know, evil or harm or malintent. Sometimes it just means vanity in the Hebrew. Think of this as vanity. It is the exertion of oneself, well-intended though it may be, that rather ends up in a nothingness, a puff, a vain panting, or a vain exertion. And the older I get, the more I see much of modern politics as a vain panting that always comes to nothingness. How many political seasons have we voted based upon claims that this was going to get done and that this was going to be lessened and that finally we had the man or the woman that was going to do this for us? For the majority of my time in this environment, I have been all in on this vain puffing. Nearly 60 years later, I'm beginning to see much of it for what it really is. A lot of it is a vanity. There's only so much that a government can actually do and accomplish. Governments can only regulate, not change people. Which is why nowadays I lean more heavily upon religion. Government is the way it is because the people it is meant to govern are the way that they are. A word that has caught fire recently is systematic corruption. It's very similar to a word used in religious circles, universal, when it comes to our observable depravity and its related symptoms. Man intends to do well, intends to improve, intends to manage himself better. How is man to do that? Can the blind man lead the blind without them falling, both falling into the ditch? For all of our pleasant political intentions, what is it, other than vain panting, that we have been able to work up and sustain? Even the few things that we have been able to establish, we've later gone in and stolen from or looted from in order to get to the next vain thing that we want. Surely, not all that we've done is completely wrong, but there too, not any of it has begun or remained completely right, either. How do we change this about our current political climate? I don't really think we could really do anything about this until, one, we realize that the Lord indeed does abhor this about us, and two, we each come to a better sense of what we can rationally expect any government to be able to do for us. And three, we each come to a better sense of what we ourselves have to do for ourselves, individually, and as families, and as neighborhoods, and as communities, as states, as congregations. The fifth thing, feet that be swift in running to mischief. Headlong is the sense of this Hebrew saying. Swift is easy flowing, few restrictions to hold it back. Running is the haste or hurry behind that we put to it. And mischief is along the lines of calamity. Now, whether the calamity is intended or whether it is a result of the intemperance, not holding the emotion towards it back, is for the individual situation to decide. I do not intend for you any calamity. Neither do I believe that you intend for my calamity. We both intend for what is best for our city or state or country. With our present proud look, lying tongues, shedding blood, vain puffing schemes, calamity might well be what we both end up at, however. It seems so right at the time, though, doesn't it? If this is what my opposition is doing to me, then this is what I'm going to do to them. Or this is what I have to do to circumvent that which they're doing. You and I can survive calamity on a personal scale much more easily than a society can. Calamity in that case comes upon morality. Calamity comes upon the mutual trust we allow each other and the security we feel in each other's presence. It comes upon our mutual perceptions of justice and mutual perceptions of law enforcement's ability to maintain the sobriety or the integrity of the society. You know, academics applaud, for instance, the speed and completeness with which the Marxists were able to take down the bourgeoisie class in revolutionary Russia. What they cannot applaud is that those people, those Marxists, were never able to repair the calamity inflicted upon trust, inflicted upon morality, inflicted upon the perceptions of justice, inflicted upon the perception of law being able to maintain the society's order. That was inflicted at that same instance upon the proletariat. No, they never recovered. They endured the calamity of losing these foundations, but they never fully recovered to this very day. Calamity then is not intended, nor is it foreseen. Yet there is very little other than these foundations restricting us from arriving there. Precisely. Another sense of this that I can think of is when politicians run to the accusations that their opponent will certainly bring upon us calamity. You know, if this happens, the sky is going to fall, right? And so we elect that person based on that. The politician then is in a noble position of being the one to save us from this great impending calamity. Rarely is any of this rhetoric ever so. How do we change this? Well, we all agree to be on the watch for it and not let it affect us, stir us, inflame us up so. Sixth thing, a false witness that speaketh lies. Now, this gives us the sense that this is testifying under sworn oath or sworn obligation, testifying under that situation falsely. This behavior goes beyond the more common lying tongue attitude addressed before. Certain players in this game have either a moral obligation or a sworn obligation to tell the truth because of their role or elected position. This behavior listed uses its more common lying tongue to mislead or deceive the agency or the court or the government body or the American public that it is sworn to accurately testify before and honorably represent. The false witness here indicates perpetrating a sham upon the fair and just proceedings explicitly concerned here. In this current climate, I think of the responsibility of the media to its viewing and reading public. The responsibility of the FBI and the CIA to get its intelligence correct. For the State Department, for the Justice Department to conduct themselves responsibly. For the House, for the Senate, for the Executive Branch, for the Supreme Court to behave honorably. Certain well-known and certain not-so-well-known individuals or groups within these responsible bodies have behaved in a way that if it's not illegal, it's at the very least unethical and most partisan. I hate this. You hate this. These bodies even, themselves, the more outstanding members of them, these bodies hate this, and they're embarrassed by this. Yet this behavior seemingly cannot be stopped, and often, unfortunately, it's rewarded. The term deep state has come to represent this, the part within our own government and media that lurks privily, the Bible would put it, lurks privily with ulterior motives. At a time when our country is so politically divided and at polar extremes, this type of behavior is most disruptive and inexcusable by either party. The primary obligation of these bad actors was not to their party affiliations or political ideologies. It was to the American people. They failed us. But now we are making future political decisions based upon a fury of converging misinformation. The seventh thing, he that soweth discord among brethren. Think of this as planting strife where there should be an affinity or a resemblance or a commonality or a brotherhood. He that soweth discord among brethren. There should be a common affinity among us, left and right, gay, straight, male, female, black, white, rich, poor, whatever. There should be an affinity, a common affinity amongst us. None of us should look past or look down upon any other. None of us should communicate falsities or misrepresentations or omissions knowingly or without thorough inspection, personal inspection. None of us should attack the person or reputation or livelihoods of our opposition. We should all be aware of our propensity towards vain exertions, especially when it comes to government. And temperance, not haste, should be our preventative measure against calamity. We all have a sworn obligation to each other and to our country to seek out the full truth and testify to it when called upon, even if the truth hurts our personal agenda or narratives. We should do all these things, one, because the Lord, else ourselves, mutually, abhor anything less than this. Two, because it sows discord among those who should rather have a hospitable affinity towards each other. I'm not saying peace and compromise just so we all get along. I'm saying political sobriety, because we are all fallen creatures. So my final conclusion, I ask again, having now considered these seven abhorrent things, what am I doing? What are you doing? What are we adding to this current angry political climate? Oh, we well know what it is that the climate is doing to each of us. How then do we go about doing something to bring it back down to something more normal? And friend, there will always be these seven behaviors to contend with. Question is, how do we contend with them together?